Welcome to the History of the Catholic Church series. My name is Father Cody, and I'm your host. Over the course of the next 21 lectures, we'll be working through the 20 centuries of church history, looking at historical, political, cultural, church developments, spiritual developments, and much more. So stay tuned as we dive deep into church history and see what the church is and how she got to where she is today. Welcome to my first episode on the history of the Catholic Church. My name is Father Cody Williams, and today we'll be discussing the prehistory that leads into the first century and the foundation of the Church. Before we get into that, I do feel like it's very important for me to give you the philosophy of what I'm doing, largely because a while ago I listened to a series in which the author gave the philosophy at the very end. If I had known his philosophical framework, I would have not have listened to the series. I hope the same for you. If you don't like the philosophical approach that I have towards history or the way I'm going to lead this series, then you can find something else that will better fit what you're looking for. Nevertheless, my philosophy is this. History needs to be in context. So often we think of history as isolated events, or we think of it as a development of one theme or idea outside of its historical context. All these things give us a very truncated or jolted view of history, to the point where it's hard to see how things developed and why things did the way they did. So in this series, I really do want to emphasize context. I will do my best to ensure that in each part, in each series, in each century, we do look at what's happening in that century, not just from a European perspective, but also from a global perspective. There's a lot of different events throughout the world that will have changing effects on both the church and the history of the world in general. So that's my first philosophy, that I want to emphasize context. As emphasizing context, I'm not going to jump in right where the church begins, which would be the death of Jesus. Instead, I want to go back and see how Jewish history and all the things around Jewish history lead into church history and greatly influence not just the church, but Judaism and Christianity. The way I'm organizing this series is century by century. So each episode is an individual century. It's not thematic. And the reason why I'm choosing not to go thematic is because often when we talk about things as themes, like the papacy, or spirituality, or the rise of monasteries, we see them as an event of their own outside of the context that formed them. In the same way, even though I am focusing on century after century, if you look at the written notes, the notes themselves are thematic. So that in that century, what are the developments of the papacy, or spirituality, or political nature of Europe in general. So that if you were to take the notes, you can follow one strand through the centuries and see how it develops on its own, such as spirituality or sacraments. But as far as how I'm going to present it in this audio version, I'm going to run through and kind of work around all these themes so that they interplay into one cohesive whole of what the century looks like. So that as you follow through all the 21 centuries, you'll be able to see how things develop, what their context was, and why we get to where we are today, which is the big goal. How did we get to where we are today? What developed? A lot of people assume that in an audio series like this, or any other kind of series on church, that our goal is to sanitize the church and make it look all good and glorious. I don't intend to. I want you to see the ugliness of what has happened and how that led to either reform or led to changes or developed into what we have today. A good example is the 9th and 10th century, where we have the decline of the papacy. It is an ugly era of fighting between Roman families and how that leads to issues in the papacy. We have some of the worst popes in history. And why sanitize it? That is what it is. You can judge how you wish. But nevertheless, I do not wish to. I want to present history as history and let you make the judgments if you need or watch it. We don't have to make judgments. We can just let it unfold and see what it becomes. So let us head in. This first part of the series focuses on the prehistory leading up to the Christian era and in many ways up to this foundation of the church. But it has to go back a long ways. This is going to encompass 6 centuries worth of history so that we can see how Judaism developed and how that led into Christianity and the foundation of the church. The most pivotal moment that I want to start with is the Babylonian exile. Back way back, with the starting of the land of Israel in around 1100, 1200 BC, we had the state of Israel established as a country. The Jewish people thought for the longest time that that was going to be their land. Nothing was ever going to happen. God was going to provide for their every need, and they had nothing to worry about. Well, that worked until the Assyrian Empire rose to power and conquered the northern tribe. But that wasn't the most pivotal moment, because for many ways they were still Jewish, they still had the kingship, they still had the temple. It was when Babylon rose to power that everything changed. Babylon would rise to power somewhere at the beginning of the 6th century BC and would go along and they would conquer all the Assyrian Empire and continue to head west. Babylon would be strong enough to come over the mountains and then conquer all of what Assyria had conquered of the northern tribes, then conquer Judah. This is a very important moment. Babylon was strong enough to make a large empire. Not strong enough to conquer Egypt or Greece, but strong enough to conquer the Jews. As conquered people, they were sent into exile. Babylon's philosophy is, if you want to keep down the uprisings, then you send your nobles into exile, and all the king's people, all the officials of the land, make them into a little plush society so that they're happy and content, and then you make the peasants do your work. It works. If you placate all the nobles, then they don't have a reason to uprise. Their life is good. Life is easy. What difference does it make? The peasants are in the same situation they were before, feeling powerless and having kind of some authority over them regardless. So for the most part, it didn't affect the peasants. On a more grand scale, it did have far-reaching effects. First of all, Babylon destroyed the temple. The temple was gone. The sacrifices were over. It's hard for us to conceptualize what this would be like for us because there's nothing in our society that compares to what the Jewish people would have felt. And when 9/11 happened and the Pentagon was attacked, it was devastating. Even if they were to have destroyed the White House, it would be devastating, but it doesn't destroy our national identity. It wouldn't change the way we operate or what we do. The temple being destroyed not only changed their national identity, because now God is gone. He left his temple. But the sacrifices that were necessary for them to feel forgiven, to feel God's grace, to know that they are his people, that's over. The core of their religion was gone. There aren't any major analogies to use here. I think the best analogy I can use to draw some sort of idea of what this would be like is if our house burned down. If my house burned down with all of my stuff in it, that's not only my identity, but my history, all my things, gone in an instant. It would be devastating. But it's still not my full identity like what the Jewish people experienced. That's why this is so hard for us to grasp. The temple is gone. The city is destroyed. The kingship is over. Where is God? So the Babylonians will continue to influence their rule over the land of Israel for the next 70 years before something new happens. And this is Persia. Persia is a very different empire. When Persia rises to power, now being east of where Babylon resided, they would go on to a massive conquest. Persia would be successful enough to take out everything from modern day India, all the way west through the Babylonian era, through to Judea, and basically stop there. They didn't make it to Egypt, and they didn't conquer Greece either, but it is a massive empire. Persia had a very different policy. Persia split its domain into chunks that were ruled by different rulers based on the ethnic origins of each place. Doing so, they allowed each group to keep their own religious practices as long as they didn't conflict with the Persian rule and the people continued to pay their taxes. Great. This is awesome. Now, in scripture, namely the end of the books, the historical books, that would be the Second Chronicles and a little bit into Nehemiah and Ezra, they really capture Persia in a very strange light. For the Jewish people, Persia is their savior. Cyrus the great conqueror of the Babylonians, becomes almost like a messiah figure, in that he is so influential in letting the people go that they idolize him. But we have to go further than that. Cyrus the Great did far more than just release the people from captivity. He sent them home. He let them practice their religion again. He financed the rebuilding of the temple and built it 30% larger. Additionally, he rebuilt the walls around Jerusalem and established them as their people again. Israel was back after 70 years of exile. Which, when you think about it, 70 years is a long time. That means that two generations have passed that didn't know what the sacrifices were like. They didn't know what it was like to be Jewish. Or in this case, Israeli. So Persia was highly influential. Not only did Persia allow the free exercise of religion, but they gave them their land back, rebuilt the land, and everyone liked Persia. Persia was great. Persia had problems, though. Persia had a lot of issues with internal squabbles amongst their nobility. And a great example comes from the interplay between Cyrus the Great and then Darius the Great. Cyrus the Great is the conqueror who established the land of Persia. His son, who took over, did not like what the Jewish people were doing, especially considering he got a report that they're rebuilding the walls for the sake of rebelling against Persia. So he halted the rebuilding. Darius the Great, or Darius, however you wish to pronounce it, succeeded him and heard the plea of the Jewish people and said, "It's okay. That was wrong. You can keep building." So under Darius, the next big savior figure, they rebuilt everything. But this isn't where we need to stop. We need to keep going. To the west of Persia, a new empire was forming. What used to be a bunch of city-states who were basically connected by the same type of religion, these city-states would now see a huge major power just to their east, and that's Persia. As little warring city-states, they really can't do much amongst themselves. They're way too weak. Until a man named Philip of Macedonia rises to power. Philip, coming from the region of Macedonia, will think and strive and succeed in bringing all these city-states together to make what we call Greece. Greece will be very powerful. Philip will be very powerful as well. But Philip's main accomplishment is largely just establishing the land of Greece, bringing the city-states together, and forming himself as the emperor or the king of Greece. Who really takes on this role will be his son, Alexander, known as Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great will go on a conquest, namely because Persia's at his borders. So in order to keep the land secure and fight in such a way as to survive, they had to fight against Persia. Persia, for the most part, was unsuccessful in their battles against Greece, with the exception of the one major one we all know about, which is Thermopylae. At the Battle of Thermopylae, the Greeks were heavily defeated. After that point, which is actually before the time of Alexander the Great, then Alexander will take over and he will start a conquest. He will go on and he will conquer everything east. Alexander will go and conquer Israel, Palestine, the land of Persia, and North Africa, and create the largest empire we've seen yet. As he is finishing his final battles with Persia, them not being fully conquered by the Greeks, only significantly halted, as he's fighting this final battle with the Persians, he comes down with typhoid fever and dies on the battlefield. After his death, four military commanders, split up the land of Greece into four chunks, called the Tetrarchy. One person controls the region of Greece and Turkey, one controls North Africa, one Israel-Palestine, and the last one, the eastern chunk near Persia. This idea of the Tetrarchy will come back many times as Rome takes on the same model in the 3rd and 4th centuries. As the Tetrarchy develops, so do conflicts amongst these different groups. Although they're all Greek and they focus on Greek things, the reality is there's lots of different people within this empire. The people of Egypt are complicit, the people of Greece are complicit, but the Israelites are not. As we read in 1st and 2nd Maccabees, it didn't go as quite as well as they thought. According to these books, the Greeks required them to worship the Greek gods. They required them to pay tribute to Greece, not the biggest of issues, but also required them to do things like cover the mark of their circumcision, to study Greek literature, and more importantly, to do the things that go with Greek religion. Now, this is the thing we often forget. We always think of it in a modern context, as though I can choose what church I go to, just choose a different church, it'll be fine. That's not how Greece operates. Everything is imbued with this sense of religion. Everything. If you read the book of Revelation, namely the first four chapters, you'll get a strong sense of the Roman level that came from the Greek era. So let's say I'm a Greek man of the 2nd century BC. I'm trying to live my life, do my thing, and this is how it works. Let's say I'm a carpenter by trade. If I'm going to go and be part of the Guild of Carpenters, they're going to have a deity associated with carpentry and a deity associated with that particular guild of carpenters, and maybe even that specific house of carpenters. This is the level of worship that comes through the Greek era. In order for me to just be a carpenter, I have to sacrifice to the gods. I have to pray to the gods. I have to work with the gods. There's no way out of it. If I'm going to ignore that and become like a peasant farmer doing my own thing on my own land, even the major festivals that happen to be social events were all centered around the deities. There is almost no way to escape this sense of worshiping these other gods. Let's say I go to the market one day. I'm going to buy some meat. Where'd the meat come from? We don't think about it because in our supermarkets, we go and we buy some ham or we buy some pork or we buy some beef and we go home and cook it up. The meat that came to the marketplaces in the Greek era could have been from any number of sources. It could have come just from a farm. Very unlikely, but it could have. More than likely, what it was someone took let's say, cow and brought it to the temple, let's say Apollo, and sacrificed the bull to the god Apollo. After sacrificing it, since it's way too much meat for the family to eat, they'd take it down to the market, sell it to the marketplace, and now the market would sell that beef to the locals. Jewish people can't eat that meat. It's meat sacrificed to idols. It's forbidden. So it's hard for even a Jewish person to figure out how to live their religion in the midst of this very Greek world. You can't buy things from the marketplace. You can't engage in social behaviors. You can't even become part of a guild without having to worship some sort of deity. This is the great challenge. And so the Jewish people will feel this and the oppression of Greece as Greece forces this kind of religion upon them. As we hear from the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees, they are forced to even to the point of death. They had to cover the mark of their circumcision, be willing to eat meat sacrificed to idols, eat pork, violate the Sabbath, all these different things that were part of Greek rule. The reason is very simple. If everyone follows the same religion and the same rules, everyone's at peace, the world works. That is the Greek philosophy. Some modern historians have challenged this idea of what Greece did to Israel, thinking that it's too harsh to match what the Greeks would have done. That being said, as we head into the age of the Romans, I want you to keep in mind the difference in perspective between what the Jewish people think of the Romans versus what the Jewish people think of the Greeks. Another wonderful example of what I mean is the guy named Antiochus Epiphanes IV, who was the tetrarch of the Israel-Palestine area during the reign, the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees. His name of its own gives us a great sense of what the Greeks were like. Antiochus Epiphanes, the great revealer of God. He made himself a god of his own, and his name makes that point clear. Epiphanes means the ruler, or the revealer, or the one who makes known, or the revealed. It can go a lot of different directions. But nevertheless, he's the great revealed from the gods. So, as we head out of the Greek era, and we get a sense of how the Greeks operated in controlling Israel-Palestine and the conflicts with the Jews, we now head into another era. West of the Greeks. I never understood why no one looks west. Every major empire came from the West, well, I guess also from the East. There's always someone new. To the west of Greece, we have Rome. Rome won't be established for a little while longer, but these little tribes are banding together to form what we'd call the Roman Empire. They kind of just emerged on the scene as an incredibly strong nation with this exceptional military tactic. Rome will do something that's surprising. Their battle strategy is don't turn your back. It works really well. If you keep in formation and never turn your back, you have no weak points. And so with this technique, also called the flanks, which is also the name of the unit, they would go forward and just massively conquer the empire. Just incredibly successful. Rome will go and they'll conquer from Spain all the way through North Africa, all the way across the empire, all the way through to the border with Persia. No one seems to be able to conquer Persia yet. Regardless, this will be a massive empire and largely a Mediterranean empire. They don't go much north and they don't go much south. Everything about the Roman Empire centers around the Mediterranean. The way the military is structured, and this makes a lot of sense for order, is it's grouped into groups. So it's grouped into groups of thousands called legions, then they are divided into hundreds with a ruler over each hundred, and then they're divided into tens with a ruler over each group of ten. So now you have a very strong chain of command that goes from the top down through large, smaller and smaller chunks down to a group of ten, which means you can exercise great control over individual peoples and make sure everything functions smoothly. The Roman Empire, in strong contrast to the Greeks, were more of a militaristic and engineering empire. The Greeks were more of a philosophical or social empire. The Romans will adopt most of what the Greeks had. They'll adopt Greek language, Greek culture, Greek religion, Greek ways of learning, all of that they'll just accept. The rest of it, they will add on engineering. They'll build massive buildings, not just buildings, but roads, infrastructure, aqueducts. The Roman era is an era of great expansion. The Romans, however, were also very big on slavery. And for such a massive empire where you had so much food and resources to keep it going, you had to have a significant amount of workforce. And the cheapest workforce there is slaves. At the height of the Roman Empire, 60% of the empire was slaves. 60%. In order to keep the slaves from uprising, since they encompassed the majority of the empire, that crucifixion was developed, although not new, it was first used by the Persians as a way to encourage those who think of uprising to not. Namely, if you don't want to be tortured like this, don't fight us. Once Rome had more or less conquered all the barbarian nations around it and formed its Mediterranean Empire, it entered an era of peace. From between about 150 to 15 BC, it was basically their time of fighting and attacking and conquering. But from 15 BC till about 150 AD is called the Pax Romana, this era of peace. It's not as peaceful as you think. Largely, this peaceful era meant that they weren't attacking other nations. There's lots of internal squabbles, as we'll see with the fall of the temple in 70 AD. But nevertheless, they aren't in any major military campaign. The people get to kind of rest in peace. As this happens, the Romans are more or less complicit with a lot of things. They don't want fights. They don't want squabbles. They don't want things to happen. They just want things to be peaceful. You know, enjoy life, eat your lavish foods, slaves will do your work, let it go. And so, for the most part, things are peaceful. The Romans make a deal with the Jews that they can continue to practice their religion as they see fit and follow the Jewish customs as long as they don't fight the empire. And it goes all right. The Jews more or less are complicit, and even major figure like Herod, he would finance the building of the temple. He's trying to make it even grander for them as a way of placating the Jews and making them feel good about this era of Roman rule. For the most part, they're placated, but in the back of their mind, what's on every Jewish person's mind is, when is it going to be like the Greek age again? How much will Rome let us be peaceful and kind of work together. And when were they going to be, that's it, we're done. No more of you. So all the Jews are rather cautious at the moment. What is Rome going to do? So as we end with this section on the political nature of the world that led up to the first century, I want to take a moment to recognize that we are not done. I stopped intentionally here so that when the next episode on the first century, we can see how the political system of Rome heavily influenced the foundation of the church and Jewish-Christian as well as Jewish-Roman relationships. As we finish the political side, I want to head into the social side. There's a lot of developments that happen in this era we often forget. Starting back with the Greek era, as I mentioned earlier before, the Greek area is dominated by education, philosophy, religion. These are the three things that dominate the Greek era. And someone like Alexander the Great, who was a great patron of the arts, and someone who loved the idea of learning, he financed the building of the Great Lighthouse of Alexandria. His goal was to have every work in the empire translated into Greek and in that library. Quite an audacious goal. But nevertheless, he strove for that. He strove for learning. His philosophy was, if everyone followed the same religion, the same philosophy, the same beliefs, and the same culture, we would truly be united and peace would reign. This is still the philosophy that many people use, that plurality leads to chaos, whereas uniformity leads to peace. So as the Greeks took over the land of Israel, a number of developments happened within Israel that radically changed not only the Jewish faith, but set the tone for the Christian faith. One of the big ones was philosophy. Through the influence of the Greeks, Greek philosophy entered the land of Israel. Some of the most notable ones would be like Plato, Socrates, who would bring this idea of Socratic dialogue, this kind of idea of questioning and diving into deeper topics through the idea of questioning and solidifying what our definitions are and what we believe. Aristotle emerged on the scene 200 years before this, and he established a scientific side of philosophy. How do we know what we know? What is the world about? What is the nature of things? So as all these different philosophies start to enter the land of Israel, so does the Jewish faith begin to adopt these into books of the Bible, such as the Book of Wisdom, or the Book of Job, or the Book of Sirach. All these different books start to bring in this philosophical understanding, this new idea of approaching the world, and influence the way they understand God. Give you a sense of some of these philosophies, just so you get a sense of what will become very dominant in the Christian era. The first major type of philosophy is called Stoic philosophy. The term comes from the action that these philosophers took. Namely, they stood around in the alcoves to buildings and just thought about things. Stoic comes from the word to stand. The Stoic philosophy is based on the idea that the world is bad and evil, and the idea of pure intellect is good. Our goal is to escape our bodies and leave the evil of the world, that we may live in a world of knowledge and understanding and reasoning, and that will lead us to true peace and joy. So in many ways, the Stoic philosophers were dualistic. They believed in this duality between good and evil, knowledge and reasoning being good, the world and pleasure and stuff of that nature being evil. Socrates is greatly influenced by Stoic philosophy, seeing this idea of Platonic forms, which is the second form. Socrates, Plato, namely because we don't quite know, Socrates wrote some things, but Plato was his scribe, and he added more later. Plato will invent this idea called Platonic forms. Platonic forms are based on the idea that everything in the world has an ideal form, and we know that idea in our heads. It's also up in the realm of forms, where the ideals of everything are kept. Everything participates in this ideal form to a greater and lesser extent. Some things to greater extent, some things to lesser extent. And we know these by virtue of reason. Let's take, for instance, a tree. If I were to walk through the woods and I see a tall structure with wood and branches and needles, I'm going to say that's a tree. Why? Because that's what the ideal form of a tree looks like. That particular one may resemble it more. However, some kid comes up to me with a drawing of a green squiggle and a brown line, it doesn't quite resemble a tree as much as the one I found in the woods, so it deviates more from the ideal form. Nevertheless, they all have a specific form. That is what we call tree, or in the words of Platonic philosophy, treeness. What is it? It is a tree. We can use other examples too, like most tables have one major stem and a big flat top. That's not all tables. Some tables are small and slender, some are really long, some are very ornate. They all have different styles, and some don't quite match what we think of a table. But nevertheless, if we were to ask, what is it? We would answer, a table. Why? Because it has tableness in it, the ideal form of a table. The last major type of philosophy will come from Aristotle. Aristotle deviates very strongly from the Socrates' Platonic model. Aristotle wants to develop a branch of philosophy that focuses on things, be able to ask the question, what is it and why? So in this, there's a duality that explains what things are. They have accidents, and then they have their thingness, what makes it what it is. If we go back to the idea of a tree, the nature of the tree is a tree. That's what it is. But what it represents itself as is its accident. It may be green. It may be brown in the winter. It may be relation to another tree. All these different aspects relate to color, size, the distance or relationship to other things, its weight. All these different characteristics we use to define things are called accidents. Therefore, everything that exists has a nature to it, a thingness. It describes what it is. Additionally, everything has characteristics or accidents that describe how it is different from everything else, distinguishing it from everything else. Aristotle will also go on to develop a kind of virtue ethics, the first major ethics after Socrates, Plato. This virtue ethics is designed to allow us to figure out how we ought to act in the world, how to act rightly, and what that looks like for each individual person. It's a little challenging to understand. Its basic idea was each virtue falls within the middle between two extremes. For instance, the virtue of courage falls between timidity and foolhardiness. If I want to be truly courageous, I have to know when to act and how to act, and when to leave, flee, or when to make a different agreement. True courage falls in knowing how I ought to act in situations that require the virtue of courage. As we move into the Roman era, not much changes. The main changes are with the values that Rome places upon its people. The Greek language is still highly used and the most common language used by the people. Latin, in contrast, is used by the elite. So that through the use of language, the Romans can make a very sharp distinction between who is in the upper echelons of society and who is not. The educated, the elite, the leaders of Rome spoke Latin, everyone else spoke Greek. As the Romans conquered the world, however, they established a massive network of trade, establishing trade with China and then India, Persia, but also with all the Mediterranean, those to the north and those to the south. These trade routes brought an exceptional wealth to Rome. Rome was so wealthy that the people actually commented on it being like a whore, that it just raped the people of the world and brought in all its luxury so it can sit on its wealth and enjoy its time. Which is why, during the Pax Romana, people were very critical of Rome as being way too opulent for the good of the society, with so many people being basically treated like dirt, slaves. So those are the main things that happen. We have a strong rift in the relationship between the elite and the people, but we also have a kind of new era of free exercise or pseudo-free exercise of religion within the parameters of the Roman government. As I mentioned earlier with the Greek gods, Rome's much the same way. They just switched all the Greek names to Roman names and kept all the gods. It was really that simple. Rome was not as big on philosophy as the Greeks were. Greek philosophy still cycles around the empire and is used in areas of learning, like in Alexandria, but it's not as highly prized as it was during the Greek era. The Romans more highly emphasized legality and rhetoric, the ability to speak, and the legal system of Rome. These two things dominate the school system. The last section I have for this episode is on religion. We need to understand what religion was like for the Jewish people and how this led through these three major eras into the first century. Before all this began, the Jewish people were strongly affected by their laws. They were required to sacrifice every time they committed a major sin, on major feast days, including Passover and the Sabbath, and then Yom Kippur and the feast days that go with the cycles of the harvest season, plowing and sowing, and then also reaping at the end. There were lots of different events throughout the year that required animal sacrifices or duties to the temple and various rituals that go with that. Once the Persians conquer all of Israel and sent the nobles into exile, destroyed the temple, and destroyed Jerusalem, a whole new era dawned. And the answer as to why is very simple. They can't practice their religion. Where are they going to practice it? The temple is destroyed. Everything prior to the exile was focused on that temple. Without the temple, you can't be Jewish. It's really that simple. So as the nobles are in exile, they're trying to figure out, how do we keep our religion alive? How do we understand it in light of not having temple sacrifices? This develops into what's called the Midrash tradition. The Midrash tradition focuses on the interpretation of law. Different scholars would get together and they discuss, how does God intend for us to follow the law? This comes from two major sources. The first one was that people are now very deeply concerned about what God wants from them. Clearly, they messed up, and God is punishing them. So they messed up somewhere in the following of God's laws and the keeping of the covenant. Therefore, by looking through the laws, they can find where they messed up, fix it, and then go home free. That's the goal. So as they're poring over these texts, and they're trying to figure out what the legal system is, on what they ought to do, they develop a whole new type of religion that's based on the books of law. As a quick side note, some scholars believe this was the era in which the books of law were written. Even the biblical account says that's not true. More than likely, they have been writing them down for quite a few centuries leading up to this so that they could read them during the temple events, or they could have them on hand in the temple. Namely, after coming back, the priest finds the scroll of the book of Deuteronomy in the temple, like this forgotten book of law that changes everything, and now they can follow God's laws again. As they stay in exile and start reflecting on their laws, they develop what's called the synagogal tradition. The synagogal tradition means that no longer is the Jewish faith focused strictly on the temple. Now it can be celebrated in local communities with a synagogue and a rabbi or teacher presiding over the event. Each Sabbath, they would gather, read from the law, interpret the law, and be given the instructions on how to follow God's will. This would be the synagogue, or synagogue worship. Hymns, namely psalms, reading, and then a reflection or a sermon would follow from that. Then people would go home, live the rest of their Sabbath, following the Jewish laws, and continue on. Once they return back from exile, the synagogal or the written tradition does not end. It begins anew. Even with the rebuilding of the temple, the restart of the priesthood, and the restart of the sacrifices, the two kind of mesh together into one. There is the group that heads the temple, which will later be called the Sadducees. They follow in with the Mosaic law and what was expected from the temple and what they expect from the people as far as sacrifices. But then the Pharisaic tradition, which will be later called Pharisees, develops in the synagogues, that the people, the locals of each little village, would get together at their synagogue on the Sabbath and continue the tradition that happened during exile. For the most part, these two groups more or less get along. They're on the same basic track. And it continues that way for a while until we enter the Greek Age. During the Greek Age, they grapple with the same basic problems. How do we follow the Jewish laws given the fact what the Greeks are doing? They're setting up statues of gods all over the place. The emperor of our land has made himself a god. They even put an abomination in the temple. They put a statue in the temple itself. How much more can you really hurt the Jewish people besides defiling their temple? And this leads to a great amount of discontentment between the Jews and the Greeks. Now, for the most part, throughout the Greek era, we don't have much of a change in religion. We have additions. With Greek philosophy and Greek language, so do Greek concepts enter into scripture and, more importantly, into the minds of the people. They begin reflecting on things like, who is God? What is his nature? What does he desire for us? How can we come to know him? What is the difference between good and evil? Why do good people suffer? Why do evil people get away with what they're doing? All these questions become the dominant focus of the Jewish religion as they're wrestling with these concepts and wrestling with the challenges of their world. Similarly, two new concepts enter into the Greek mindset, the Jewish mindset by Greek philosophy: resurrection and also martyrdom. Although martyrdom is not technically new, the idea of dying for the faith is. In the same way as the brothers of Maccabeus make a point in the books of Maccabees, the seven brothers make a point that if they keep true to the covenant, make sure to follow God's laws more faithfully, then something great awaits them even after death. That is new. Under Roman rule, these same mentalities continue. Rome was a lot more placid towards the Jews, making a nice alliance with them that they would continue their temple sacrifices and do what they ought to, but they can't go against Rome. This now leads to a conflict between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. The Pharisees feel like the Romans are much like the Greeks. They're a pagan, heretical group that needs to get out of our country. They don't belong here. We need our country back. We don't want even a Roman soldier on our land. The Sadducees are like, we're going to do our temple worship thing, and since we're able to keep the sacrifices going, this is good enough. This leads to great tension between the Pharisees and Sadducees as they disagree on the nature of Rome and how they ought to either comply or fight against Rome. Also, in this century, as we head into the first century AD, we have a new concept arising within the land of Israel, the idea of a Messiah. As Israel has now been under occupation for 500 years, there's a great desire for freedom, liberation, a new kingship, a rise of a new power that will allow them to finally be what God has always intended, his special people. So, up to 20 different men in this era claimed to be the Messiah, which makes people wonder, what will the Messiah be like? Where should we find him? What will he do? How will we know when he's here? Some people will follow one for a while until it's proven, hey, that guy was not the Messiah. Where others will be very, very reluctant to follow anyone until proven that that person truly is the Messiah. Which leads to the tensions that will start in this first century as Jesus comes to the scene and he claims to be the Messiah, but the Jewish people are always already very reluctant. Do we go against Rome? Do we change our ways? Could this guy be the right one? What are we looking for? So a lot of things summarize and end this era leading to the first century. We're now wondering, is the Messiah going to come? How long will the Jewish people be under Roman occupation? What is Rome going to do? How will the people comply? How will this lead into the dawn of Christianity? Music for this series comes from freemusicarchive.org. I'm using the song titled Faith in Humanity by Audio Result. It has been truncated so that it fits with the places I need the audio and is not in its full form.